There's a very good chance that something goes really, really wrong in the next couple of weeks to months. And yet the markets just don't seem to care. The downside momentum, I think, crescendoed in February on that sell-off to 60K. I would say that I've got an 80% chance that the bottom is in.
Meet James Check, better known as Checkmatey on X.
As one of the world's top Bitcoin on-chain analysts and the former lead at the renowned Glassnode, James has now launched his own brand, Check On Chain.
His mission, to educate investors on Bitcoin's market dynamics through insightful analysis and engaging content.
Where are the sellers? If we get through 85, the odds are we're going up to 95. Once we get above the 95, 50-week moving average, you won't find a bear anyway, because...
Hey guys, don't skip this part. There's something for you to win here. We're running a 21-day sprint and giving away 3 signed copies of our Bitcoin book to listeners who help grow the show on Fountain. There are 3 ways to win. Either become the top supporter and cumulative sats zapped over this 21-day period, or provide the most Bitcoin-like zap, meaning you don't just zap big, but in style. Or last but not least, create the most amount of valuable content around any episode during this 21-day period on either X or Noster. Provided you are a subscriber to the show on Fountain, have reposted the sprint post on Noster or X, and emerge as the leader in any of the categories mentioned above, you'll be the proud owner of a new Bitcoin book in no time. We'll share an update of the leaderboard on each show during the campaign. Good luck, and now on to today's show. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today, yet again, joining me is Jack from Check on Chain. So James, it's amazing to have you back.
Thanks for having me back, Pascal.
Yes, it's always good to have you and get your perspective, obviously, in such interesting times that we're living through. I feel like I can say it every week, you know, like everything. We seem to be living in a very interesting time, but it feels at least so. So yeah, how are you feeling with everything going on?
It's simultaneously easy and very hard as like a market practitioner, as an analyst. There's a lot of things that like are really obvious. So for example, let's just take everything that's going on in Iran, Strait of Hormuz. Very obvious that oil was going to go up, right? As soon as you start seeing those headlines and you start seeing the wind up to it, very obvious that oil was going to go up. Also very obvious is that it should just destroy everything else. You know what I mean? And then like, why not? Why hasn't that happened? And then you got to go like, then the nuance kicks in. You got to go deeper down the rabbit hole and understand, oh, there's, you know, oil reserves everywhere, right? The countries have got stockpiles of it, but they're depleting that at a very rapid rate. And at some point, the ships that left in February finally arrive at port. So it takes like a month. So we're now at the point where those ships have, so like the delayed effect of things, stocks are at all-time high, stocks are mooning. And this is kind of the market saying, the AI thing, the productivity in all this stuff, the CapEx spend is outweighing the immediacy of what if oil starts to crack the economy. But then at some point, the oil is going to crack the economy, right? You leave it up here at $100. There's a reason oil doesn't stay above $100. It's demand destroying. And I can, you know, from my own personal perspective, we had flights booked to the UK in April. They got canceled because they were going through Dubai. We could have rebooked them. We chose not to because the fares were 3 times more expensive. So our demand was indeed destroyed. So just as one example, but it's fascinating. For me as an analyst, we are in fourth turning days. Very hard to have a good grasp on things. And I think a lot of folks get caught on the short-term stuff naturally. Human beings want to understand like what's going to happen the next couple of weeks. And Lynn Alden does a good job of illustrating this. It is much easier. To be fair, it is much easier to form a confident, and that's the right word here, not predictive, confident. It's much easier to have confidence in the long-term trajectory of things. In the shorter your time frame, the more just random walk it is. And that's why we're in this very interesting period where like there's a very good chance that something goes really, really wrong in the next couple of weeks to months. And yet the markets just don't seem to care. And which one do you end up trusting? For me, I try to look across many markets. Does the bond market tell me the same thing as the oil market, same thing as the dollar, same thing as... And when you've got like a lot of big markets moving in the same direction, then you're like, okay, I think there's a trend here that you can trust. But yeah, for me, it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating, it's terrifying, it's exhilarating, it's frustrating or boring at times, it's all of the above.
That's exactly right. That was well described. I mean, you know, me working as a money manager as well on the side, you know, with colleagues and stuff, and they've been very, as you said, you know, just flabbergasted by the whole situation. And they're also, we're managing Swiss money, you know, and Swiss money is kind of said to be very, very boring, but very stable and everything. Also the Swiss companies, you know, but you have Nestle and like company, like these big companies moving like 4 or 5% a day, you know, and my boss, he's been telling me, I mean, in 30 to 40 years of his career, this has never happened, you know, and now you find yourself like these big behemoths, like they're trading like crazy, like meme stocks, you know, and so,
yeah.
And he's like, wow, that's kind of crazy. And they're now looking for solutions as well, because how do you rethink this situation? You know, because I mean, as a money manager, like, you're stuck.
Nvidia hit what, 4 trillion several months back. Now yeah. Google's up there at 4 trillion, like just getting your head around. Sometimes just for fun, when I write about in my articles, you know, I'll talk about like $40 billion or something, or $6 billion going in or out of the ETFs for Bitcoin. And I'll be like, okay, let me just quickly punch in an LLM, like, give me some like measurements of how big $40 billion or $5 billion is. And you're like, it's semis and semi-trailers just full of paper money. And like, you know, I think one that said it was like, you know, 2 billion hamburgers. I'm like, oh, great. I can really visualize 2 billion hamburgers. But, you know, it's things like this. And then you start talking about like, that was like a $5 trillion or $6 trillion thing. I think I was talking about total outflows. And then you go, okay, well, how many billions fit in a trillion? You know, like what's the difference between a billion and a trillion? It's approximately a trillion. It's just so much bigger. So the size of the numbers and these market caps, you know, like Nvidia puts in a 5% candle and it's $200 billion or some crazy number like that. It's like, it's just astounding how big these moves are. Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating. It is. It's highly volatile. Great for traders. I think most people aren't traders and shouldn't be traders. I do believe we're in a world where active management is becoming a lot more important. But at the same time, that's where, from my perspective, I think most people should not be actively managing. Like, I don't mean not like being aware and making portfolio adjustments and things. When I say active, I mean like trading hourly, daily, weekly. You know, most people want to buy and just go and do their job. That is a hard environment. You've really got to think about that longer term, and you've actually got to be able to tune out a lot of the daily noise and understand the big macro trends. Because if you get caught up, right, this is why I call it chop solidation, one of the reasons. If you just get caught up in the swings up and down, you will lose your mind. You know, like you would just go crazy, because sometimes it just chops around and goes nowhere and it's meaningless. It's just the market like reestablishing equilibrium.
Which is kind of like the hard thing, to your point. You know, like again, when you come to human psychology, humans just want to naturally do things. You know, that's how I feel. Like it's not something I want to be in a state of rest. You know, like I want to do something about it. And if I know I got to be invested, because that's, I think, something which is trickling down to the not the lowest, but like to the people the farthest away from markets. But even they're getting nowadays, because of the inflation happening and everything in our fiat system, they got to be invested. And then they, you know, they buy a portfolio or like a set of stocks. And at some point they're like, I got to do something, you know, because I hear this, I hear that. And it's a clear point, the chop solidation. I mean, again, it's so hard to overcome this tendency of just say, okay, I want to cancel out all the noise because I might not know better afterwards, you know. But that's, you're fighting this inner urge of wanting to do something as a human, you know, because otherwise you're like, yeah, it's luck, or I don't know, I got to do something about it.
And that's part of the game, right? Because you need to do something, right? There are times when cash is the right position, and having some cash is always not a bad idea. But at the same time, it depends what your time frame is. Are you holding cash for 5 years? Because in that case, you're going to get smacked by debasement. Because the governments are all in a terrible position. But then it really depends. Like, we're also in a world where the currencies are highly volatile. For example, for us as a business, we looked at strategies products as like an income supplement, right? So, I mean, because our bank gives us, you know, 4% if you're lucky. You got to work hard for it. And like, you know, we've got some money sitting on the side to make sure that in a rainy day we can pay ourselves and all the rest of it. And I looked into Stretch, you know, it's paying 11.5%. There's all sorts of risks associated with it itself, but for a short term, like, you know, 6 months type thing, just park some money on the side. But then we got the Australian dollar started strengthening. And if we had have bought and held it, we did buy, but I got out of it because the dollar started appreciating. $100 is not worth as much in Aussie dollars anymore. So we would have actually lost like a year and a half worth of dividends if we had just held it. So you've got to start thinking in the Forex world as well, because currencies are now super volatile and they're also information. Now, I'm no currency trader, but certainly like understanding that the Australian dollar, what do we do? We build houses and we dig stuff out of the ground. What does the world need right now? We need the stuff that we dig out of the ground. Commodity markets. So, and commodities are doing very well, right? Gold front ran and now all the, I looked at the copper chart today. Looks like it wants to just go absolute moon mission. BHP, right? Big miner, lots of copper copper assets starting to really perform, right? One of the biggest stocks in Australia. So yeah, there's a ton of things going on that like, it's a fascinating world. As a markets person, I love it. I think it's amazing, but it is terrifying because things can go wrong, right? And Craig Tyndall, yeah, you had on, he spoke about this. Things can go wrong.
And that's kind of like where I'm at as well. You know, like it's all these sort of, yeah, even sometimes we call them doomers, you know, and to some point there are sort of doomers because like I've seen so many people predicting the failure of the fiat system altogether. You know, we know it in Bitcoin well enough. And now it, also with these cycles, you know, it's going to be the AI trade is going to blow up and everything. And it hasn't. And maybe at some point they will be right. But like, that's kind of like the challenge you're in, you know, predicting.
I mean, Peter Schiff had hair like me when he started talking about the debasement trade, right? Now he's gone silver waiting for it to go up. And yeah, it takes a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And so yeah, you just kind of be humbled by the market. And that's also what probably as a takeaway people need to take away. Yeah, it's so hard to kind of predict stuff. And that's why it probably just makes sense, as you said, you know, if you're not a trader, don't trade. Yeah. When it comes to Bitcoin, you know, that's also kind of interesting currently. When I talk to my colleagues, you know, some of them are saying, why is Bitcoin up, you know, in this situation? And it had such a good run in the last couple of weeks, you know, and then other people are saying, well, but it's still sort of behind equities, you know, equities are at all-time high, Bitcoin is not. How it's kind of disappointing. And so you have both of these sides, you know, some of our kind of, both of them are disappointed in a way because they have probably been sidelined and others are like, no, but it should have gone higher. What do you make of the Bitcoin market right now, you know?
Yeah, so I think there's a few ways to look at this. Leading into, so the back end of 2025, if we're going to talk about long duration assets like Bitcoin, you've got to take a longer duration view. Just over the last couple of years, 2023, end of the 2022 bear market. That's why it's actually important because everything got smacked at the end of the 22 bear market. Bitcoin kicked ass up until about January 2025. So the end of 22, start of 2023, all the way through to the start of 2025, Bitcoin kicked everything. It then started to underperform, and I would underperform marginally everything else. So gold started running, equity started really running, the AI trade really ramped up. Bitcoin more or less traded sideways to a little bit down, so a little bit downside versus other assets, but still up versus bonds and fiat. And then in October, so Bitcoin's already had if you were a four-year cycler, it's had the exact 1,050 days that, you know, it's supposed to have, exactly that amount of days of upside versus fiat. It topped and then it had a 50% drawdown. Now, bear markets had their own beast. Too many people buy too many coins at the top. They then fall underwater. They sell. It creates more sell side, blah, blah, blah. The market then just has to offload a lot of risk, a lot of leverage, does its job. That right? Bear markets are a process of just reshuffling ownership. Now, other assets then did fairly well. But if you look at how silver, including Bitcoin's bear market, so I ran this study about a month ago. Silver, if you go back and anchor to the end of the 22 bear market, silver went parabolic. It matched Bitcoin's performance, including the up and the drawdown of the bear. So silver basically caught up to what Bitcoin had done over the course of the last 2 years. Now, of course, if you're holding Bitcoin, no one cares about that fact because they're down 50% from the all-time high, but you also rode a very good wave higher. Gold didn't, I think Bitcoin was still up like 2x versus gold over that 23 to 26 period. Equities would be even more dollars. It's still substantially higher than where it was at the end of that bear. So that's one angle to look at it. Now, Bitcoin since, I think it was basically since the end of February, start of Operation Epic Fury, so the start of the war in Iran, Bitcoin has actually outperformed most assets. Now, obviously, it's not going to outperform every single individual stock, but I'm talking about your equity indices, gold. I mean, it's up 50% versus silver and gold, right? Relative terms. Silver, I think, I don't know what gold is, 30% or something. Anyway, we're in this world where Bitcoin is, it's kind of shed, it has shed a lot of downside risk. In my opinion, the downside momentum, I think, crescendoed in February on that sell-off to 60K. I've spoken and written about this at length. I mean, my inbox as an analyst was slammed, totally. I smelt the fear. I had messages coming in being like, dude, is it over? And I was like, I don't think so, but I like this sentiment. So my view has more or less been that that was what I call the price paying capitulation. That is the point where everyone who was scared of downside, there's a few things that hurt in a bear. One is the downside, just literally I bought the top and I got slammed. The other one is I had, look at my portfolio all-time high. I didn't realize enough of it and their profits dissipate. And then the other one is time. Bear markets just take ages and people just lose interest. So I think in February, we flushed out all the price sensitive buyers, those first 2 points of losses and evaporating profits. Then I believe that we moved into a period of bottom formation. Now, that bottom formation range, I think, could be anywhere between 54K, which is the realized price, and 78K, which is the true market mean. We've broken above that level now. We're above the short-term holder cost basis, which is quite very meaningful. We've held it on a weekly basis now. We're chopping around like 80, 81 right now. I don't think we're out of the woods because just I think I want to see this oil shock. I just have a feeling that we haven't seen the final chapter of it yet. However, I do not think that the downside momentum for Bitcoin is taking us to 40K, 30K, where some of the bears want it to go. I think the downside momentum has crescendoed. 2022 was actually the only bear market where we set a lower low after the price pain capitulation, which was in June when 3 hours blew up. FTX was required to do that. So I think that I would say that I've got an 80% chance that the bottom is in. The higher we go, and the fact we're trading at 81 and a holding there, I think the odds of that are going higher. So I do think that, like, for downside risk, there's a lot of people who wish, and I know this for a fact because I hear from them, there's a lot of people who wish they had have bought a lot more below 70K. I won't bore people with the details, but my models basically say that 70K and below is the bottom 20% of mean reversion. So choose your anchor, the 200-week, 200-day on-chain models. That was the bottom fifth of the cycle. Now, for me as a hodler, again, going back to our first part of the conversation, I'm not that fussed about, I don't care about like the intraday swings. I'll write about and help understand it. But for me, you're going to give me the bottom fifth. I don't know how long it's going to last. I don't know how deep it's going to go. All I know is that everything below 70K is what I call deep value, and I'm a happy buyer. Dollar cost average all through there and lump sum whenever it has a big nasty red candle. That's more or less been my position. We're now in an interesting state where at 80K, it's no longer the most discounted it's been. We're in the like 33, 35% of mean reversion on the downside. Still nice. Still early, like recovery type bull stuff, late stage bears. I'd love to see the market go down a little bit lower, get that extra fear point, you know, just flush everybody out. But I don't know if that's going to happen. We have genuine demand coming into the market. So I'm very constructive. I think the downside is limited. I think the bear case of it going to 40K, and I'll be happy to be wrong, but I don't believe that that's what's likely to happen. So yeah, I think it's an interesting point in time.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, to your points, I want to talk about the current situation, but maybe just coming back once more about the, you know, the story that's being told, even though it's just a story and in the end, it doesn't matter, you know, because we know, got to look at the numbers. But like now with Bitcoin's run, if you talk to TradFi people, are you explaining it more in sense of like you see actual fundamentals, you know, that have driven Bitcoin outside of Bitcoin? Or is it sort of idiosyncratic fundamentals in the sense of Bitcoin was just way overbought and now had at least this counter rally, and we'll see if it's just a counter rally in that sense? Or like, how do you explain what's been happening with Bitcoin? Because some people are already now like kind of very cheering and, oh, see, even during war, Bitcoin is this great diversifier. And it is, obviously, because the numbers are telling us, but what's the fundamentals behind it? You know, like the stories we like to tell each other, like, sure. What do you make of the situation?
Yeah, there's a few things. So one thing I found that I'll just put as a sideline character here, I have found I've been playing around with my own X algorithm. So I know a lot of people use Twitter X to try and get like a sentiment read. I spent 20 minutes liking all the bullish posts, and my feed immediately became moon boys and people who were the most bearish, like 6K, 5K, it's going to zero people, right? The kind of people who like, oh, I'm going to really like that bullish post, and oh, look at this idiot, let me reply to him. And then I did the opposite. I started liking a few bear posts. And within like 2 minutes, my whole feed completely reversed. It's crazy. It's two completely separate worlds. So I've actually found that to be useless. Truthfully, I found it completely useless. So I then go back and say, and I say this all the time, I love when the narrative on Twitter doesn't show up in the data. Now, there's a few angles. I mean, my thesis about the bottom formation, I've more or less had, I won't go into the details because it's a bit nuanced, but I've had that thesis for some time between the realized price and the true market mean, 78, just say 80K and 54K. That's been my bottom formation range since the like January 2025. I started writing about this as my base case. Now, what we started seeing on that February sell-off, a tremendous amount of loss. People who had bought the top and hodled all the way down just capitulated. The losses were extraordinary and they went on for months. $600 million a day of just people being like, nah, I'm out, right? And that's just the delta between their purchase price and the sell price. So huge amounts of pain. And simultaneously, the folks who have coins below 60K, they're in profit. The war has just started. It's now a month in. Now it's 2 months in. You know what they didn't do? They didn't sell. They didn't ramp up their selling at all. So I take this whole picture and I go, okay, let me just look at the fundamental case here. Losses were a bottom forming level, fear, true fear. The people who are in profit are very aware it's a bear market. They're very aware that the oil shock is coming. They're very aware that markets may go lower and they were not de-risking. They're not, even now, they're not de-risking and selling. So there's a story in what the smart money are not doing. If they're not selling, they're either in wait and see mode or they're in accumulation mode. Mean reversion, below 70K, bottom 20%. If I can see it, I'm not the only one, right? The smart people who can do a mean reversion model around the 200-day moving average, right? They can work this out. So people are aware that it was a discounted zone and it was probably oversold. Then you see things like Morgan Stanley launching an ETF and then bringing it into their brokerage after there's a whole pool of ETFs already in existence. And you're like, has Morgan Stanley done the research? Do they know their customers? Of course they do. They understand that this is a very good idea. So you just look at all these different things. You go, I just think that people got so bearish at the bottom. And by the way, there's another element on the shorter term stuff. We've seen futures markets being like negative funding rates for the longest time I've ever seen. And this just means there's only two explanations for it. Someone is buying very big, is buying spot and hedging. I think that it's happening, but it's not a big part of it because I think the days of a big institution buying an ETF and then hedging on Binance on a perp is not happening. So it's just not like a practical thing for them to do. They just buy a put option. You know what I mean? Like use the IBIT options. So I think that the hedging case is okay, but also it means they're buying spot. They're buying spot to then hedge their downside. And then the other one is you've got speculators who want the market to go lower. Now, when I left my Twitter profile alone and I didn't engage with the world, I started to notice more and more bear posts, a lot more people calling, and they all had the exact same chart. Bear flag down to 40K, bear flag down to 40K. I made a collage of just all of these charts. And like, as I was making my report to write about it, my Twitter feed would refresh. I'm like, oh, look, there's another one. I can't even fit these on the page anymore. And they were all the exact same chart. And from my perspective in the on-chain view, it looks to me like we've had a major flush out. Now, this is the interesting thing. It is not as bad as previous bears. Just the fact that we went down 52%, not 75% is significant. But it actually looks, the only two equivalents to this kind of like meaningful drawdown, but not as severe, is 2019 and the mid sell off in like May, June, July, 2021. We sold off and then we went back to all time high. Now there's a bunch of our own characteristics around that too, but they're the only times that we had an equivalent from an on-chain perspective amount of people were scared, but it wasn't a shit, Bitcoin is going to zero. It wasn't a complete like loss of confidence the way that FTX was. Now, some can argue that means that we're just going lower because we haven't hit like the true pain yet. Possible. Very, very possible. But there's just enough signs now that there aren't enough people willing to sell. You know, like the smart money just stopped selling at 80K. So once we're at 60, like you know, if my like capitulation radar goes up, there's a lot of smart people who saw the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. No, makes a ton of sense. I mean, you've been pointing out these three different levels, you know, of the defense that the bears will have or will want to defend. Can you name these and explain the relevance of each, like, you know, these different levels that you were pointing out?
Sure. Oh, and sorry, before I do, let me just add two more bits to my previous comment. ETFs in aggregate, their AUM, I checked this like 2 weeks ago, it might even be higher by now. They were like 3% off all-time highs in terms of AUM.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where are the sellers? And the last one is in terms of, we can measure where capital is accumulated, right? We can look at it on like a bar chart. Imagine like a volume profile. Show me where everyone's cost basis is. Mm-hmm. The 2018 and the 22 bear market, both bottom with 25% of the capital in that like bottom formation range. Right. 3K to 5K was in 2018, 15 to 25 was 2022. We got to 28% before we bounced. And I'm like, you know, like that was the target to get to 25. We got to 28, market bounced. So two more fundamental elements. Now on the three lines of defense. So on the way down, as we peaked in 2025, there were three key levels that you can almost think about like momentum deteriorates below these levels. On the way down, it was 115 or 100, I think it was 115 was the short-term cost basis. Once you go below the short-term cost basis, all the people who bought recently on average are now underwater. Now, once we went below 110 was when that happened. Mm-hmm. Then 105. And by the way, the gap between these, 105, 100, and then 95. Mm-hmm. Once we got down to 105K, we got to the midpoint of where everyone's cost basis was. We now had like 30% of the wealth underwater. Mm-hmm. We could recover from that. So that's the second line of defense. Once we got down to 100, we were now at the point where like 50% of the wealth was underwater. And the trip to 95 took us to 65. So if you think about this like an exponential, the people who bought the top are suddenly a lot more underwater. And all the people who were at break even between 100 and 105 and 95, they're all now underwater. So that was, my line was 95K was the bull's last stand. But my argument was, by the time you get to 100, the odds are you're going to 95. You go to 95, I think it's over. If you break 105, like these are small price gaps. They're not big moves. So the idea was risk to the downside compounds very quickly. Every 5K increment you drop. Now on the way back up, it's more or less the same. You've got a bunch of people who just bought the bottom, but you've also got all the people who are still waiting saying, ooh, maybe I can get my money back on the way up. So you've got to bust through all those resistance levels. So the first line of defense was 78K, which we're holding above at the moment. That's the short-term holder cost basis. Same thing on the downside. That's the first sign that, hey guys, momentum may be starting to switch in the other direction. And the true market mean, which is, in my opinion, and statistically speaking, the most perfect mean reversion model. It just is the center of gravity for Bitcoin's market. And that's the average cost basis for everyone who's active. It gets rid of Satoshi and early miners and all that stuff. So 78 is the first line of defense. 83 to 85 is the 200-day moving average and also just a really big cluster of people who bought at the start of the year. We've had I guess you could say one really big bear flag. We sold off in November to 80K. We ranged until February. Tons of people bought there thinking it was a dip. Then we sold off to 60. The center of gravity of that's like 85K. So I'm just going to say the second line of defense is 83 to 85. Once you get above that, the next level is 95K, and 95 is the 50-week moving average. Very simple. Every technical analyst under the sun, they know that when Bitcoin breaks the 50-week, the target's the 200-week, which is at 60K now. We kind of hit it. We didn't quite hit the 200-week. It was trading at like 59.4. Yeah. We sold off to 60. It's, you know.
You might find an exchange where it got hit even, like some tiny exchange.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to haggle over that last 3%. So anyway, I believe we hit the 200 week. Once we get above the 95, 50 week moving average, you won't find a bear anyway, because they just have to accept that the bear case is dead. So then you go back to my previous logic. We're above 78. The odds of us getting to the 83 to 85 zone is higher. It's going to be hard to get through. There's just a lot of reasons why the bears will put up a fight. But if we get through 85, 83, 85, the odds are we're going up to 95. And once you're at 95, the bears are going to say, you know, and it's funny that it's the same level as the bull's last stand. It's like you kind of already lost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because that would be my follow-up question, to know when have we lost as bears, you know, like yes, as just a general term, you know, but like we are currently, as you said, trading above the first line of defense, you know, this 70-ish K level. And then, so the question is like, how do we know that this has really been like decisively taken and it's been breached? And obviously it's just this game of odds, you know, and then continuum in that sense. We never really know. Usually we know in hindsight, you know, that exactly, oh, that's we actually kind of breached it decisively. But then for a trader, it's already too late, you know, because then you're always higher prices. And
it's all about, so we don't know that the bottom is in, V with a capital V. We don't know when the bottom is in until we're 6 months past it. And then you look back and go, oh yeah, it turns out 60K was the bottom. So you don't know. But the idea is we're then saying, okay, at some point, the bottom will be in. Unless Bitcoin goes to zero, right? That's a whole different discussion. At some point, the bear market floor will go in. And then what we're trying to do is work backwards and say, when do you have the confidence to say, I think it's probably there? So from my perspective, at 60K, I released a report saying, literally at 60K, welcome to deep value. And in that report, I said, I have no idea if this is the bottom, but I'll tell you what, it is not the top. And by every metric I look at, we're in highly discounted territory. This is deep value territory. So the idea is like, if you are a dispassionate long-term investor, Bitcoin is tremendous value anywhere below 70K. We're trading at 60 for me personally, going nuts. Then we're going to work backwards and say, well, let's say we're 6 months down the road. What are the levels we're going to look back at and say, oh, that was obviously like the first, like, ooh, maybe I should start. If I'm a bear, we broke 78. I should probably at least consider the bull case. Then you get to 83, 85. You go, well, this is not a bear flag anymore. It looks like there's actually some strength. And then by the time you get to 95, you've lost that 60K to 95K move. But you're buying a more de-risked asset in theory. But a lot of, and I think you actually asked me this on Twitter, and you were saying, I can't remember the exact structure of the question, but you're basically saying, are you more bullish now that it's 80K? And for me, I'm actually, it's no, it's the opposite. I was super bullish at the 60K. Even though I didn't know where the bottom was, I'm like, the models are telling me this is time to accumulate. If it goes lower, that's great. I'll buy more because it just, to me, it's all discounted. Once you get to 95 and the bears start flipping to bulls, you're now in the territory where it's like it's becoming a bit more consensus. So you're, for me, risk goes up the higher you go. And this is why on all of my Bitcoin charts, whenever you see, I do pricing bands, you know, statistical deviations, all that stuff. Red is always top. I always use red for the top and green for the bottom, because for me, most people want to be long. As a long-term investor, you actually want to buy the scariest candles, not the most exciting candles. And a lot of people, we have to fight our natural instincts to not buy silver when it's $120 because everyone else is buying it, right?
Yeah. No, exactly. But that's exactly what I think is where the challenge is at. You know, as you said, like if an asset is in deep value and it moves higher, then obviously, there's less risk in the sense of like, okay, it feels there's less risk. But I mean, if you feel like there might be a mean reversion trade, you know, that's why you want to get less bullish. At the same time, there are these like line of defenses, you know, who have maybe decisively been breached. And then, you know, okay, you never know, but then there's not that much of a chance that it will actually go below again. So in some sense, you will get more bullish, but then also, less bullish. It's kind of like very hard, you know, to chuckle these
two. I've received
two.
Lots of questions. I think to really illustrate your point there, recently I received a lot. So I've been beating the drum since the 5th of February saying, this is deep value. Like,
yeah.
Not knowing the future, this is deep value. Now that we're at 80, a lot of messages I'm receiving is, hey, I really didn't buy anywhere near as much as I wanted in the 60s. How low do you think the next correction is going to be? To which my answer is, I mean, now we're into like predicting the random walk. I couldn't tell you. I don't know, mate. Like, but all I know is there's a lot of people who are in the exact same, I didn't buy enough, that if they had prices at like 58 and it didn't get hit, they might buy at 70. And then if they don't buy to 70, they might chase it at 85.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, again, you know, there's, I've been talking to other people, you know, and maybe I can squeeze some, I already did, but some more practical advice out of you. And even though I know that you can't give financial advice, but like, other people I respect, they look like Dr. Jeff Ross, or I look to people like from the Bitcoin layer, Nick Badia and Johan Bergman and all these people and some other people, you know, I trust. When I read their stuff, anyone is like, okay, you know, we're now in this counter trend rally up to the 80K range. And then I also know of people because they sold now a bit, you know, a chunk, because they feel like, okay, there's going to be this mean reversion trade. Like hoping for lower prices. But then again, at what point do you think they should really reconsider their strategy? You know, or what would be a good strategy if you're sort of trapped now because you felt like, okay, I sell, but now it's hovering at 80. I don't know. You know, should I be buying back in? Like, what would you do if you were in that and there?
There's only one answer to this question. And in my opinion, it's the only right answer. Just dollar cost average. Just dollar cost average. Because what I love about dollar cost averaging, it's so simple. It's hard to do because people get excited to do stuff. And like my simple strategy is if I'm in the bottom fifth, daily DCA as heavy as I can. And then anytime I get a big red candle, I just flush a bank account, buy as much as I can. And that's more or less been our strategy. If we're now in this like 80K region, there's obviously, you've got to make your own assessment. Everything, you've got to look back and say, will we look back and say 60K was the bottom? If so, you know, like this is no longer a bear flag. This is now like, we'll probably pull back and get some kind of a higher low, I think is the most likely scenario. Just dollar cost average, because if you buy and it goes up, you're buying an appreciating asset. Well done. If you buy and it goes down, that's great. You get to buy more next time. So from an emotional standpoint, dollar cost averaging is so powerful because you just remove, you systematically remove your emotion. That is the thing that drives people to make mistakes. And I've done this many times. Everyone who's been in markets has done this. You get to this exact moment, market rallies to 85. You go, oh man, I got to buy. You plow everything in and it goes down to 72. And then you go, why did I do that? And then you puke it all out again. And then of course, that's the higher low and away it goes. Just DCA the whole thing. Just dollar cost average, because it just takes the emotion away. If you want to own the asset, just DCA in, because you got to let go of this. Like I can tell what's going to happen in the next 2, 3, 4 months. Just think about what are you going to do? Like, who are you buying it for as well? I often use this because, again, some people are active traders. I don't really talk to active traders. Most people are hodlers, long-term investors. Are you buying this asset for 6-month you, or are you buying it for 6-year you? Because if you're buying it for 6-year you, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. That's for sure. Yeah, it's a good point. It really comes down to who you're talking to, you know, and exactly most of the people are. And as we said, shouldn't be active traders. And that's why they shouldn't be thinking in that sort of category. Maybe one more nerdy question, you know, because I got you on the line. I mean, some people I know that are reading your newsletter as well, and you had this idea that you, as you already said, you popularized the realized price, you know, maybe not something we will hit this cycle. True market mean is a lot closer. Then still a lot of people are saying, okay, we had this short-term holder cost basis fall below realized price in past markets. And now maybe it's not going to be the realized price anymore, but it's going to fall below the true market mean because it's still sort of now hovering above it. Now, my question is, would there be like another price capitulation for this to happen, or can it just fall below through job solidation?
There's no reason they have to touch. No, there's no reason they have to touch. Yeah. No, the way I think, I mean, again, the short-term cost, but for the folks who aren't familiar with these terms, the realized price. So one of the beautiful things about on-chain data and Bitcoin, it's a big database of who owns what and when. Every coin, rather than like the market cap, you take every coin value at the current spot price. Not really indicative because some coins were bought at 10K. Some coins like Satoshis have a zero price. So what we do with the realized cap is we give every coin and we value it based on when it last transacted on-chain. So think about like if someone bought at 126K and they're still holding it, that coin is valued at 126K times the BTC value. So it values every coin when it last moves. Now, the realized price is you just divide that by supply. And what you get there is you say, what is the average cost basis for every Bitcoin? Now, the problem with that, in the numerator, the value of every coin when it last moved, Satoshi, for example, 1.1 million Bitcoin, contributed zero to that numerator, nothing, because they moved at a zero price. But they are included in the denominator, which is heavily diluting. If you know how ratios work, you've got a small number in the top and you've got a big number at the bottom. You're going to get an underestimate. Now, the problem is to get to the realized price, which is 54K, that's the break-even level, so to speak. Satoshi's got $110 billion worth of unrealized profit at the realized price. you need 100, and he can't take those profits. So he can't reduce that number. The people who bought the top have to be holding $110 billion of unrealized loss and not sell. But they do. They're active investors. They feel emotions. They give up. They capitulate. They have fear. So they can reduce their unrealized loss. So the problem with the realized price, it underestimates by design because it's got this like bedrock of profit baked into it that has to be offset by losses that actually do get crystallized. And then you get a smart buyer come in and buy those coins. The true market mean discounts those coins. So Satoshi's coins have never moved. And the more of them, if you think about them like a health bar, how much of the coin has moved versus not moved? Satoshi's is 100% not moved. We discount it 100%. Coins that moved yesterday are 100% moved. We consider them in full. So it's like a big grading system for how active coins are. Now, the true market mean is the average cost basis for active investors, not per Bitcoin, for active investors. What do active investors feel? Emotions. What drives markets? Emotions. So that is, in my opinion, the correct level. Now, the short-term cost basis is just looking at people in the last 5 months. Now, they are disproportionately going to be active investors because they're literally moving their coins. So the short-term cost basis converging with, this is actually a really important point. It's like 78.1. The true market means like 78. It's the same number. You know what I mean? Like they touched. That convergence is actually very important. Because short-term holders, we generally think of as speculators, fast money, right? People who are hot ball of money. Who are the people who are buying coins, who are short-term holders, after a 50% down, prices below, strategies cost basis, it's below the ETF cost basis, the headlines are all bearish, gold is mooning, equities are mooning, Bitcoin is dead. So yes, they are technically short-term holders, but when the short-term, think about this like a convergence. If the short-term holders are the average active investor and the short-term holders are hodlers, who is the average active investor?
Yeah.
So you end up with a homogenous mass of you and I, people who know why we're here. So, you know, to me, that's just a signal in itself, right? So no, they're not perfectly crossed, but we've got the convergence that we were looking for.
Yeah, very interesting. And that's so insightful, I guess, when I also got to understand this, you know, and you helped me with understanding this a lot. I mean, one more question in terms of like, you know, Bitcoin realized cap change, because I see a lot of people sharing on-chain data nowadays, me sometimes included. And yeah, a lot of people, I get the feeling they don't not really know, or they don't quite know what they're doing here, you know. And some people have been sharing this Bitcoin realized cap change 30 days, you know, it's been in negative territory for the last 75 days and had only just recently ticked above of zero again. And some say the conclusion is this is an indication that the pressure came from top buyers selling, but new spot demand has not been confirmed yet. Is that a fair conclusion to draw from this indicator? I wouldn't think so, right?
No, so look, the realized cap, so going back to that original metric, and the realized cap, by the way, it's the backbone. In my opinion, is the most important metric in Bitcoin. If we value every coin at the price it last moved, just for simple math, if you buy Bitcoin at 10K and you put it in a cold storage wallet, you save 10 grand times the coin price, but for simple math, you save $10,000. Even if the price is 70, you save 10 grand. So the realized cap really represents how much wealth Bitcoiners have saved in Bitcoin based on when they last transacted. Now, that number is $1.08 trillion. It's a big number. That's how much money Bitcoiners have invested into this asset, over $1 trillion. Now, if you buy at 10K and you sell at 100, someone had to come in with the extra 90K worth of difference. So when you see the realized cap increase, it's a capital inflow. Someone had to bring in more money to buy the same thing at a higher price. In a bear market, people who buy the top, they buy 100, they sell 50, they kind of destroyed half their money, right? Because someone bought the same coin at half the price. You kind of just destroyed capital. So that's a capital outflow from the system. So when the realized cap goes back to being positive, it's telling you two things. One, that the losses have, it's one of two things, because the realized cap is total profit minus loss, cumulative sum of profit minus loss. So if your realized cap has stopped going down, that means that your losses are now either being offset by profit taking, or you're getting it's a capital inflow, right? You're going from capital destruction to capital inflow. So yeah, it's a good sign. I mean, look, simple maths here. Nothing good happens when the price is below the short-term cost basis. Nothing good happens when the realized cap is declining. A lot of good things happen when those two aren't true. So, you know, like it's just, we're back to capital appreciation. So I think it's a great sign.
Yes. Yeah. No, great. Thanks for the explanation. Well, I mean, we're almost at time, I guess, almost finishing up here, but maybe I have some last questions in rapid fire question type, you know, like stuff that I've been hearing, you know, that I would love to get your opinion on. Like, you know, some people are pointing to Bitcoin mining companies are pivoting to AI, you know, is that a problem for Bitcoin mining? And the follow-up question I hear, some economists make the argument, you know, as energy will become more expensive, Bitcoin won't be able to get the energy it needs to survive, you know. What is your counter?
Yeah, no, I disagree with both of those. So first thing, miners, two things. Miners pivoting to AI makes all the sense in the world. First and foremost, mining is a horrendous business. Horrendous. The difficulty adjustment makes you bankrupt. The coin price goes down, makes you bankrupt. The halving makes you bankrupt. Mining has always, always been a high turnover industry. And what we ended up with at the end of in 25 is like a huge concentration of publicly traded miners with a ton of hash rate, 40-odd% plus. Personally, whilst I don't wish ill for any mining business, seeing a disperse, like seeing some of those companies not have as much of a dominant role, mining is going to benefit the small entrepreneur who can find energy that's coming off a landfill somewhere and monetize that. You know, like it's a free market system. So having a dispersal of that mining hash power is actually very good. Big miners always have inertia. And by the way, they buy power and they compute with it. Mining for Bitcoin is very much like an intermittent load. It can come and go. They can switch it on and off. They can do load balancing. And then you've got AI, which is a much heavier, much bigger industry that's just on all the time. So there's certain reasons that mining is much better than AI, but there's other reasons AI is going to be much better for miners. So it's just miners doing economic decisions. What was your second question? Because there's something else I wanted to touch on.
In terms of like energy, you know, will be too expensive at some point. And then,
I mean, look, you know, this is just the free market again. It's like saying like, okay, Bitcoin goes to $1 million. Someone's not going to mine it because it's like super profitable. Like, oh, but it's hard to get. But no, they're going to find a way. The free market will find a way. And that is the whole thing about mining. There has not been a single government subsidy for the whole mining ecosystem. It's just worked out how to be the dung beetle of energy. Yeah. I got no concerns.
Yeah, no, makes sense. Like solar energy.
Life finds a way.
Yeah. No subsidy. That's a good point. What do you make of Saylor's recent comment that they might want to or might sell some Bitcoin just to test markets? Well, yeah.
They've been saying that they're going to sell Bitcoin in several of the previous earnings calls. This is the Twitter sphere picking up on the latest thing because they're bored. They've said many times that they're going to sell. And frankly, they should. Absolutely should. They're buying an asset that is with debt, they have to sell at some point in time.
Yeah.
Can you find any person in the world who buys an asset and doesn't sell it to manage their balance sheet at some point in their life? Like, the company can't die with it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, of course. It makes perfect sense.
It's just like, do you think he's losing trust with people? Because that's what some people are arguing. But maybe, again, it's losing trust with the Twitter folks, which
Who?
Yeah,
who
exactly.
Who is Saylor actually beholden to? Saylor is beholden to three parties. The people who hold his debt, the people who hold his preferreds, and then the people who hold his equity, in that order.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is at the bottom of that stack. So he's not beholden to anyone in Bitcoin, but he's absolutely beholden to his shareholders, his debt holders, and his preferred holders.
Yeah, no, makes sense. Maybe last question, you know, which is maybe somewhat an emotional one, but like, or to me at least, if I'm not mistaken, I think you recently tweeted that you watched this new documentary called Finding Satoshi, you know, and found it to be very intriguing. And I watched it as well, and I found it very good. And I wanted to kind of know why you thought it's like a good documentary and, what you got out of it.
Yeah. So, I did find it very good. The documentary was Finding Satoshi. I was fortunate enough to be given an advanced screening by the team, and I thought it was fantastic, honestly. And by the way, I wasn't paid in any way. In fact, I turned down an offer to do revenue share, so I'm purely speaking from my own belief here. I found it to be a very well-produced document. It's by far the best produced, and they focus in on two characters, Hal Finney and Len Sassaman. Now, those two, for me personally, they've always been like right guys, right place, right ethos. And I watched this documentary, and the thing that I didn't put together, which they did, is basically saying like it was the two of them, where Hal was the code and Len was the front man, right, on the forums and all the rest of it. And between the two of them, individually, they don't have the requisite skills. They certainly have the code and they worked at PGP and they knew each other and all that kind of stuff. But Hal hadn't written a white paper before, right? He's a technical dude. Yeah. Mm. Len, on the other hand, was Mr. White Paper, was all about it, right?
Mm.
And both of them have sadly passed. Now, the thing I found to be the most interesting is and I had some friends of mine who aren't heavy Bitcoiners, folks who watched it and go, it brought a tear to their eye. And
yeah,
what
exactly.
I loved about the documentary is it actually, first and foremost, I think it's the most like, makes sense. It's like, yeah. Of all the potential candidates, it's the most likely. But also, I found it very hard to watch and not walk away and go, Bitcoin really came from a good place, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
To me, it was the perfect introduction to why Bitcoin is not sinister, why it is a good tool, and where it came from a place of like true honesty, that if someone who's only ever heard bad things about Bitcoin watches like the roots of it, they go,
yeah,
it's just good, isn't it? Everything I told has been wrong. That's what I liked about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was the emotional part that I was alluding to, you know, because when I watched it, even though we, as Bitcoiners, we know, you know, Satoshi is always going to be this mystery. But I felt almost like seeing Hal Finney being depicted as such a likable guy, you know, and such a pure of heart. You felt like, I want him to be Satoshi, you know, even though he's the perfect fit, you know.
It's the perfect fit and we will never know. And I love that. And this is why I think their production quality was very good. They kept they went through a very logical, fairly thorough. They spoke to people who knew these two guys and you can hear from the people who knew them that they were honest people. And you just can't walk away from that documentary and be like, it's evil. You know what I mean? So like, I thought it really got to at a minimum, doesn't even matter who Satoshi was. It got to the core of why Bitcoin is special. And for someone who doesn't know anything about Bitcoin, it's the thing that if someone goes, how do I learn about it? Aside from Andreas Antonopoulos' video, it's actually something I would probably send them to watch because it just gives you the heart of it.
No, for me too. I was always looking for this blockbuster, going to explain who's Satoshi. But this one did a very good job of sending it to normies who have never heard about Bitcoin and they might actually walk away and like, oh, let me maybe look into this and get some Bitcoin after all.
Just puts up the radar of that's really interesting and not what I've heard. Different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love
it. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Cool. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. Thanks a lot, James, for doing this again and enjoy the rest of your day. Get settled in and let's see where Bitcoin goes next. It's always, always very interesting.
Thank you, mate. Thank you for having me back on.
Yes. Enjoy. Bye.